We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined once again by Asra Nomani. Asra is the author of the new book, Woke Army, the Red-Green Alliance that is Destroying America's Freedom. She's also a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Network. Asra, welcome back to the show.
Oh my gosh, it's so exciting to think about being able to sit down and talk to you about this book that is like a labor of love for me.
So obviously you have had a crazy set of years. I mean, just you've gone through a lot the last few years. You've accomplished a lot the last few years, and a lot of it is in the book. Can you tell us just about the process? This is just kind of a process question. What was it like to put all of this work into book form? It seems like an overwhelming task.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just so phenomenal. And I guess I'll like peg this to this little cultural zeitgeist moment we had, right, where we're discussing this big idea about, wow, when are women in their prime, right? I had to bring that up. I had to connect this to this. Because there's Don Lemon, you know, I'm a guy, talking about women just being in their prime in their 20s and 30s, and then he inches it up into the 40s, right? Mm. Well, there's just this phenomena, this question, this like, how do we contribute? When do we contribute? Where do we contribute as women also in particular? And of course, we have our childbearing years, right? That we have that are just biologically driven. And then there's this other long, long journey that we're on. And I just bring this up because I just want everybody to believe in themselves, you know? And wherever they are in their lives as women and as men. And there I was at the age of 37, okay? I had been a reporter for the Wall Street Journal for 15 years, and I found myself pregnant unexpectedly. I didn't have a wedding ring on my hand. And that year, my entire life just took a turn. It was January 23rd, 2002, that my dear friend from the Wall Street Journal, where I'd been working for 15 years, came to visit a home that I'd rented in Karachi, Pakistan, and then never returned. That was the moment that took me then, you know, from the news pages to the op-ed pages. And that's how I ended up, you know, contributing years later to The Federalist, because I finally realized, like, I had to have an opinion. I had to have an opinion and argue as a Muslim against that interpretation of Islam that had slaughtered my friend Danny. And so I just take us back there, because this journey to bringing this book to fruition started that year. You know, that as a 37-year-old young mother, hopeful as all mothers will be, and now it's 20 years later. Can you believe this, Emily? Mm. 20 years later, I'm 57 years old, and I am in my prime.
Don't tell Don that.
Yeah, I will tell Don that. And if I ever go on CNN, I've already figured out my shirt. It's going to be prime time. I'm 57 and I'm in prime time.
Well, that works on multiple levels, because he just got moved out of prime time.
Exactly. That's what I love. I just love it. That's, you know me, you know, I'm like clicking, clicking. What are all the double meanings here? Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so Emily, you know, it's just that, that same spirit that like drove me as a young reporter to work at the Wall Street Journal and be a cub reporter in DC, you know, to send me off to Pakistan and then just keep fighting to get to the facts that I lay bare then in this book, and then fight like you and I have talked about as a mama bear, you know. It's and none of these people, nothing Don Lemon says, none of the forces that try to silence us can crush us when we just stay true to, you know, those basic values, curiosity, energy, you know, and we're going to have our ups and downs for sure in life, but it's perhaps not what you were exactly asking me, but I just have been meditating on this idea of our prime these last few days and really wanting to celebrate, you know, where we're at. I'm not as fit as I wish I was. I've got what they call, I love it, wisdom highlights, you know, in my hair. But dang it, I went and did my little selfie video with my book. I'll tell you about this in a few minutes, but, you know, against one of my greatest detractors that I expose in this book, I went before their headquarters. And I wasn't looking my best, but it doesn't matter. You know, you just keep going, you keep fighting. And this little lovely book is like literally in my hands right now, 20 years of work, 20 years of work in my prime. That's my journey. That's the process.
That's amazing. That is just absolutely amazing. I feel like there's way too little, first of all, reporting, and second of all, just conversation in general about this alliance that you outline in the book. And this is a big picture question, Asra. But what, tell us about the red-green alliance. If you are looking at the cover of the book, you will know immediately what Asra means by the red-green alliance. But what do you mean when you say that, Asra?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not talking about the environmentalists, exactly. And this is such a deep, deep, you know, network that we have to really try to understand. And I invite everyone, we're going to walk through it here over this talk, but please, I have open DM. My email is astra@astranumani.com. Just shoot me an email, send me a DM, and I'll answer any questions because I'm here to educate. And I want everybody to understand this alliance that I expose in the book. Read about it in the book. This book is meant to be an inoculation, you know, to arm us against their tactics. But here is what it is. The book is called Woke Army, the Red-Green Alliance that is destroying America's freedom. So on the cover of the book, you have at the top, the red is the hammer and sickle. And it is a symbol of communism, socialism, Marxism, and also the hard left today. Leftism, wokeism. You know, put whatever term you are comfortable using on that dynamic. And then in the bottom half of the book is the green crescent and the flag, and then the crescent and star of Islam. And I am a Muslim. This is a symbol to talk about the Muslim establishment. And when I talk about them, they are people who believe in this philosophy that we call Islamism. And that is a philosophy in which you believe that the religion should be part of governance. You believe in Islamic governance. And so who are perpetrators of Islamism in the world today? You know, nations like the entire Gulf regime, right? A country like Qatar, Erdogan in Turkey, many elements of Pakistani establishment. And it is a disturbing dynamic in the United States of America. And so, Emily, this book, you know, I live in Fairfax County, Virginia, right? Where I've been one of the moms. And this book is centered here. What I discover is this Muslim establishment network, they made their roots right down the road from me, across from Route 7, at a lot back in the 80s that had the address of 500 Grove Street in Herndon, Virginia. Hmm. And there, yeah, there, these men who believed in Islamic governance started creating organizations. There are organizations that some people might have familiarity with names like the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Institute for Islamic Thought, the International Institute for Islamic Thought. And they took root. They have, you know, established a spider's web of organizations. And this is what my book was initially about, Emily, until the summer of 2000. And then in the summer of 2000, something crazy happened. And that is when these ideologues, you know, from the far left started taking aim at America's schools and the children. And what I discovered, Emily, was that the Islamists were working with them. And their intention was to try to hijack curriculum for their ideological purpose, which is mostly anti-Israel, right? And so that's how you have the emergence of ethnic studies and all sorts of politics about the Middle East, and even how 9/11 is taught in schools, so that, you know, one of our own Virginia Department of Education trainers lectured teachers and told them, don't call them terrorists. You know, so this is the trickle down of their agenda. It's very complicated, but I try to not only tell people about it, of course, but show it through alliances that we've seen, like the Women's March, you know, Linda Sarsour. Yeah. Remember Linda Sarsour?
Absolutely.
Remember, she was the Palestinian American activist who New York Times, like, you know, did puff pieces about, and vehemently anti-Israel, and she excluded who? The Israeli Jewish women who wanted to support the liberal cause of the Women's March. And that was where, you know, her true biases were revealed. And that was where intersectionalism, right, as a word, was used to create a new hierarchy of human value among people, where Israelis suddenly became white, right? And Jews became white, so that they were lower on the oppression matrix than Palestinians. And that's what I ended up kind of connecting the dots on in the summer of 2020. So Emily, talk about the process. Oh my gosh, it was, you know, because I was just like a typical reporter and writer. Like, I had to keep digging. And I was late on my deadline. Oh my gosh. I was missing deadline after deadline. My editor is Adam Bellow, the son of Saul Bellow, the famous writer. Yeah. So patient, waiting. Come on, Asra. Come on. But you know, they say that, like, you just kind of intuitively know when a book is ready. And something, the light bulb went on, as the cliche is supposed to be said, not off, you guys, don't ever use it wrong. The light bulb goes on when the light goes on. Yeah. So one of my funny things I always notice. But Emily, that summer then, when I learned about critical race theory, I rewrote the whole book. It was crazy. I went through and I dug a layer deeper in the Islamist tactics, and I realized they had been using critical race theory to racialize Muslims to make us a race, so that you couldn't criticize Islamic extremism for fear of being called a racist and an Islamophobe. And I really think, like, I want to give a shout out to procrastinating, because I think just allowing it to percolate and allowing it to just unfold allowed me to now share with the readers the roadmap for this network and how they operate and what their agenda is in really wanting to hijack America.
You must start taking care of your liver now more than ever. Why? Well, because the latest data from the American Heart Association indicates that adults with fatty liver were 3.5 times more likely to have heart failure than those without. The American Liver Foundation says that 100 million Americans have fatty liver, which means many people are at risk. We throw everything at our livers: cholesterol, alcohol, toxins, Tylenol, statins, cigarettes. That's why so many of us have a sluggish, fatty liver that makes us gain weight and lose energy. For decades now, your liver helped you with over 500 key functions every day. It's time you help your liver. There is a solution: Liver Health Formula, an all-natural supplement which contains 12 clinically proven botanicals that help recharge and protect your liver. Manufactured right here in the USA and approved by American doctors. You can try Liver Health Formula and receive 5 free gifts when you order today. First, you'll receive a free bottle of nano-powered omega-3 to keep your heart healthy. You're also getting 4 free ebooks to support every aspect of your health. Try Liver Health Formula by going to getliverhelp.com/federalist and claim your 5 free bonus gifts. That's getliverhelp.com/federalist. And you do a lot of reporting on care in the book. Mm. You preview some of that in an Unheard article. Folks should, of course, buy the book. But I'm curious to hear if you could flesh out a little bit about this organization that some people who follow this issue closely are probably familiar with, especially from the Obama years and maybe even before that. But what did you find about CARE as you were digging in the course of this book? And what is unique to your reporting? Because it's absolutely fascinating.
Oh yeah, this is my bombshell, and it is so deep for me right now to be having this out in the world, because I have been holding it like a weight upon my heart for 20 years, this experience and then the revelation. Well, what happened is that after my dear friend Danny's murder and my awakening as a Muslim reformer, I knew that I had to act, you know? And so I ended up walking into the front door of my mosque. I walked in through the front door of my mosque in Morgantown, West Virginia, and into the main hall where women were forbidden because of this interpretation of Islam that was sexist and misogynistic. And in that main hall, I challenged these men on interpretations about the idea that they could beat their wife, you know, if she was disobedient, or they could have second wives. And, you know, it was like a rat house. It was just ridiculous in there. It was just so disgusting. And they didn't like it. You know, they didn't like this woman coming in and telling them that they, you know, were preaching things from the dark ages. So I not only challenged them, Emily, but being a writer, I started writing, right, about these issues on the opinion pages. So Emily, you cannot believe this. I know you are going to have a heart attack right now. The Washington Post gave me space to write about these issues back then. Yeah. 2003, I wrote about how women have a right to walk into the front door of the mosque. 2002, I wrote about how no woman should be killed for the alleged crime of being pregnant without being married. And, you know, just really, really radical ideas like these, right? So this was the Achilles heel of the Muslim community. And you won't believe it, but I went to one of our large Muslim organizations then, this organization called the Council on American Islamic Relations, for help. I went to them for support because they said that they were a civil rights organization. And it was a violation of our civil rights not to be able to walk in through the front door. I thought we had established that as a nation, right? You can't have separate and equal because it's ultimately unequal. Well, I was lectured and I was told, we are not dealing with Islamic relations. We're dealing with American Islamic relations. And that's when, you know, CARE started doing their little campaign about the workplace that's unjust against Muslims and the school systems and the prisons and every part of American society. And they used it under the banner of concluding that it was Islamophobia when you denied a Muslim their rights. Well, what about me as a Muslim woman, right? They didn't care. And what they needed to do, it was their Achilles heel, this issue of women's rights. They needed to discredit me and all the other reformers. So they started attacking us. And sometimes it was in the open, but most often it was with anonymous accounts. So this is something that somebody like Taylor Lorenz should really care about, right?
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So I've tagged Taylor Lorenz in my findings now, and I haven't heard back from her yet, but I'm going to send her an email after we talk here, Emily, and I'm going to picture this story. because she is, if people don't know it already, fancies herself a disinformation reporter at the Washington Post, perhaps engaged more in disinformation, some would argue, than information. But she's supposed to care about attacks on women, right? And this is textbook, an attack on women who were coming up bravely to challenge extremist sexist interpretations of Islam. Myself, Raheel Raza, this journalist in Canada, Ayan Hirsi Ali, an ex-Muslim, you know, so many. Who else came under their crosshairs? Every conservative, of course. National Review, Federalist, back then Bill O'Reilly, the Republican Party, the GOP, the NYPD, Bill Maher then also. You know, Bill Maher, because he dared, as a liberal atheist, to challenge extremism. Well, you guys, what I did is I kept at it, and the attacks started going more and more and more anonymous. And in 2013, all of a sudden, I discovered that, oh, they've had this website up called loonwatch.com, and they're publishing these attacks on us at Loonwatch under, you're going to love this, their fake names, I figured it out, were the, okay, let's see, Emily, how well you know your biology, chronobiology, and I don't know what category this fits into, but what is Emperor Garibaldi, American Soul, and Danios? What are those four names common, do you know?
I'm going to go with Italian.
Oh, that, I love that, because you're such a smarty pants. So you know Garibaldi was a philosopher, did you?
There it is.
There you go. You're like, yeah, I knew that. Garibaldi indeed was an Italian philosopher who was famously wore a red coat. Well, guess what? There's a fish that has that same coloring. So all those terms that I gave you, American Soul is the only one that most people would know, are the names of fish species. So these guys used a naming system where their anonymous names were the names of fish species. And they used those names then for attacks on anybody who criticized the Council on American Islamic Relations, known as CAIR, or Islamic extremism. Well, I ended up using a tactic that a friend of mine developed here in Fairfax County. I filed a defamation lawsuit against John Doe's.
Hmm.
People may not know this, yeah, but when you do that, you then have a right to subpoena the internet service providers like GoDaddy, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, that where the platforms where they're using their anonymous identities. And it's, you know, being discussed right now in the Supreme Court, whether those platforms are held liable. And I got subpoena power. And that's why I want to become a lawyer, Emily, because subpoena power is awesome. It is awesome. And what I disclose in the book, in a chapter that was just so deep for me to write, is that these character assassins and their network was started, funded, and fueled by CAIR. So this civil rights organization has orchestrated a character assassination disinformation campaign against Muslim reformers and anyone who dares to challenge Islamic extremism behind the veil of their own cowardice, really. They have used big tech, and this is another big revelation that I want to share with your listeners and you, Emily. They had as an ally, it was exactly what you just hinted at a minute ago, CAIR was in with the Obama administration. And that's when my awakening happened as a Democrat, lifelong Democrat, that these guys had sold out as a party, because there was a man named Shahid Amanullah He was named the technology advisor to the State Department, and he aided and abetted this disinformation character assassination campaign.
I was going to say, it's not dissimilar to something we see happening so often now in the woke space that you're obviously intimately familiar with. It's the same playbook, basically.
Exactly. It's the exact same playbook. And they have used these tactics for their insidious objectives. And the reason why the book dares to take people to connect the dots on this is because if we don't understand how they're working together, we will never defeat them, you know? And I mean, you can just, I don't know if you can feel it, Emily, but like it is. So this is what I said is, I went with my book. I went there 2 days ago. I went to the headquarters of CARE right around the corner from the Capitol. I did my own little book reading of my book outside their headquarters on public property, on the sidewalk. I know my laws in America. And I just had to go there, you know, because I want them to know, and everybody who is fighting this fight has to live with the same ethos, you know, maybe not at this moment, but just meditate on it and get to that place where you are unapologetic, you know, in your values, and you are fearless, because they are the ones who should be scared of us, right? We should not be afraid of them. And it is so, my heart still trembles. You know, one of these characters that I exposed, he slid into my DMs last night, Emily, at 2 a.m, trying to gaslight me. Yeah. His name is Javed Hashmi. And he went by the moniker Danios, which another fish name. He comes in and he's like all like slick and savvy and like, I don't remember ever saying anything bad about you. I'm like, yeah, dude, right. I happen to have the receipt. And he works now at an organization called Muslim Public Affairs Council. And guess where he did his dirty work? He was earning his PhD at Harvard University while he was doing his disinformation campaign. So these guys talk such a big game, right? About, we got to stop disinformation and, oh, the far right, the conservatives. Well, they are architects of this. And it is just so, I'm just so, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to expose them, because that's the best thing that we can do is use sunshine, you know, to be this disinfectant in society and really disempower them.
Hey, listeners, if you're like me and enjoy diving into the week's top stories in U.S. politics mixed with humor and hot takes, you need to subscribe to the Decaf podcast right now. Give it 30 minutes of your time as hosts Mark and Taylor discuss how much influence Trump really has in the Republican Party heading into 2024, plus all things sports and pop culture. Whether you're a politico or just someone who wants to impress your friends, you won't want to miss it. Subscribe to Decaf on Apple and Spotify today. Yeah, it's striking to look at the cover of your book and see the juxtaposition with the hammer and sickle in the red and the green. And I wanted to ask, to what extent are some of these Muslim theorists interacting directly with Marx, interacting directly with communist literature, communist ideas, or even beyond communism, if we're talking just about Marxism? You know, what are we sort of seeing? You mentioned intersectionality earlier. We can trace the kind of Marxist to cultural Marxist evolution and, you know, draw that line through people like Foucault up until Kimberly Crenshaw and others, Ta-Nehisi Coates today, and all of those folks. But on the side of radical Islamism, how much interaction, what is the overlap between, you know, that actual sort of Marxism, communism on a philosophical level? How much are they interacting with that? How does it inform some of their campaigns here in the United States?
Oh, yeah. Great question. And exactly. I mean, you've identified already, you know, the roots of that nexus, right, between the left and the ideologues of socialism and Marxism and communism. But what I, you know, on a like just going back to my roots and my own upbringing as a Muslim girl, you know, in Islam, we were taught, just like with Christianity and Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, service, right? Service to community. Even this concept of social justice, you know, before it was hijacked, was a value. Social service was a value. And just in the ethos of Islam was this this kind of concept of providing. Really, in a model that is, you know, socialism light, right? With a principle of equality among people. But we can see in practice, look at any of these wealthy Muslim majority countries, right? There's no socialism being practiced there. It's totalitarianism. It's privilege, to use the woke word. It's the elite. It's disparity of income. You know, there's the exploitation of laborers, right, by the wealthy that are living at large, using capitalism as their mechanism to make themselves even richer. It's not that ideal that I was taught in Sunday school, right? In our Muslim Sunday school. But the thing is, here's how it translates. And I just could not believe that this was happening. So Emily, you can just imagine, like it's days to launch, right? From my book. And I know what I'm about to drop, right? I know how deep it is. I know these revelations about care. And the launch date is Valentine's Day, because it's like my love letter to my enemies. Like, you know what, you guys, this is for you with a big kiss on it. Well, you can't believe this. So February 14th, just imagine that this is like my big launch day. Well, January 31st, I hear really good news. I hear that there's this friend of mine from the parent movement who has just been blessed by a committee in the Virginia legislature to become a next, to be on the Board of Education. Hmm. And she's an accidental activist like me from the summer of 2020. Her name is Suparna Dutta. She came from India like I did. She had dollars in her pocket like my father as a graduate student coming to America. She made America home. Her son was a student with my son at Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology. And she, like me, was so offended when the principal told us, lectured us, and said we needed to check our privileges, right? So Suparna helped get Governor Youngkin elected. She went from being an accidental activist to just a really astute political volunteer. Well, Governor Youngkin saw her intellect and named her to the Board of Education. And she's been representing parents ever since her arrival last year on the board. But she had to get the nomination cleared by the Virginia House and Senate. And so it was great news. January 31st, we learned that the committee for the approval had passed her. All the Dems had even voted for her. Wow, awesome. Suparna's in. Well, the next night, Emily, Suparna goes to a Board of Education meeting, and there's this lady named Anne Holton. I don't know if your listeners know her, but you will know her as Mrs. Tim Kaine. She is the wife of the senator from Virginia, Tim Kaine, and she's a big bully on the Department of Education board. She was named many years ago by Democrat, of course. And there's a big debate happening about the history and social studies curriculum. Well, Suparna is standing up for the Constitution and the U.S. Declaration. And Ann Holton says, oh, those remarkable, those documents were not, quote, remarkable. Yeah.
Wow.
So she's dissing American history. And then I couldn't even believe this happened. She says that there is merit in socialism in America. She says it. And Suparna stands up to this and says, I grew up in a socialist country. India has had a long history of socialism, and it is not a system for America. It is one that is going to create, regressive direction for the United States of America. Well, I guess the activists started talking to themselves that Sunday night. It was February 5th. You just know the dates because, you know, the stuff becomes like the stuff of like trauma. The activist, leftist activist also doesn't want to talk about the trauma that they experience, but they inflict so much on us. Guess what happens? A Twitter account that is Red for Ed VA. Really subtle there, right?
Right.
So subtle. Red for Ed VA posts grainy photos of Suparna at a parents' rally back all the way to October 2021. And there was this far-right activist who tried to hijack the parents' rally with those flags for that Nick Fuentes' group, you know, right. America First Foundation. Like, we didn't even know. Like, Donald Trump didn't even know, right, about this organization and Nick Fuentes and all this. Well, he flies his flag over the parents' rally. Suparna doesn't even know what this flag is. And now they use those pictures of Suparna at that rally for parents and say she was, guess what, marching with white supremacists.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
So they turn this woman who is a Hindu-American woman of color, in their terms, into a white supremacist. And lo and behold, the next morning, you cannot believe that this happened, Emily, but mosque elders from this Islamist network that I know so well, working with CARE and these other organizations, call the Democrats, including a Virginia state senator named Chap Peterson, and they tell him, vote no on Suparna. She is a anti-Muslim Hindu extremist. And she is not. But what they had done now was exactly what's on the book cover. The socialists and the Islamist sympathizers had worked together to sabotage their enemy, right? And win this vote 2 nights later on the floor of the Senate of Virginia. It was shocking, and just 1 week till launch of my book, and I was like, did you set this up, Suparna? You know, just to like, be able to prove that this happened? And she's like, no, I had no idea. Like, she didn't know who her enemies were, and she did not know that this network was so vast and so tight, built on this concept of, quote, intersectionality. But we exposed it. She and I worked day and night. We studied tweet after tweet after tweet. And I published that just a little bit ago at Real Clear Politics because, we need to know who our adversaries are. We need to expose the network. That's all we can really do, right, as a nonviolent movement. That's what we are. We are nonviolent civil rights activists. That's what I say. And I believe it firmly because we're fighting for America's freedoms. And that means human rights and civil rights in our country as we've known it.
You know, that's a good transition to a sort of devil's advocate, or maybe it's not a devil's advocate question, which is the way in which the Marxist ideas, as they mingle with Islamism, especially overseas, Is that at all fueled by vacuums that American military interventions have left? And Oscar, you know much more about this than I do, and you've seen this up close and personal as a reporter. Afghanistan is sort of fresh in everyone's mind right now. The withdrawal, at least under Biden, is fresh in everyone's mind right now. But is there anything to that argument that as the United States sort of leaves these economic, these cultural vacuums in the wake of military interventions, then the radical Islamism and its fusion with a radical form of Marxism becomes easier for bad actors to sell to people who are really suffering overseas?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, we could absolutely and have to take responsibility wherever, you know, we're unable to really realize the kind of value systems that we wish, like as we tried for 20 years in Afghanistan. But we knew this. I was a cultural trainer. I don't think I've talked to you about this, to men and women deploying to Afghanistan for many years. I was trying to help them in the classroom in the United States experience the culture shock I knew that they would experience when they got over there. I talked to them about, you know, the way women are treated, how you have to respect the white beard, right, the elder, and you know, just shocking things like the sexual assault of boys by men, you know, this phenomenon called bachabazi or boy dancing, child dancing. And I tried to inoculate them to what they were going to experience. And unfortunately, this is what I firmly believe and know. There is nothing that we can do to appease the Islamist ideology and those ideologues. Like, we have tried. The Obama administration made serious errors in aligning themselves with the Muslim Brotherhood Islamist types because of the lobbies of people like CARE and other organizations in Herndon, Virginia. You know, they tried to tell them, oh, you're going to see something closer to democracies if you work with these folks. But they will never, ever believe in the values of America, because our values of women's rights and equal rights and, you know, even the phenomena in America, no matter what your moral position is on issues like homosexuality and LGBTQ issues, we are not a nation that puts people in jail because of, you know, adult sexual decisions, consensual adult sexual decisions anymore, you know, and they are. They put people in jail, they kill them, you know. So we are never, ever going to be in sync with them. And it is in our attempt to try to appease them that we only fail years later, like we did in Afghanistan. And, you know, sure, like the Chinese, you know, they're one of the best representations of Marxism and communism and socialism. But really, they have their foothold now in Afghanistan because of capitalism. They are going after the mineral deposits, you know, and the natural gas, right? It's not for, quote, socialist ideals that they have aligned themselves. They are going after the money and the wealth that lays beneath the land that America's, you know, engineers, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, basically did a roadmap for. We assessed where the mineral deposits are, and now those guys are going in for it. And their marriage will happen because in their instance, the communists, the socialists, they will allow the Islamists their sexism and their misogyny and their, you know, actual murder of people for being gay. They will allow them any which way that they want to live. And so we cannot consider their marriage like a failure on our part, but really, to me, it's just like the same challenge individuals face in the United States of America. Like, you don't appease values that are not your own, you know? You do not make a deal with the devil, as ironically, you know, the Islamists have done too with the alliance that they have with the communist socialists, because they're violating their values every day, right? In those alliances. I mean, it's just crazy when you see that the Islamists are with the far left at school board meetings, you know, and you're like, okay, so I guess you want to keep the women in the basement at your mosque, but you're okay with them reading Genderqueer. Okay, got it.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That makes a lot of sense.
Like, now, the parents in Dearborn who protested, yeah. Right.
Yeah, because the parents in Dearborn represent the awakening, you know, really, of Muslim parents against the woke army.
Mm-hmm.
That this is, you know, this is where the divide is going to happen, because the woke army is now coming for their kids. You know, the woke army doesn't say, oh yeah, we're going to allow an opt-out form just for the Muslim parents. They get to know if their kid changes their gender pronoun, but every other parent has to be kept in the dark. You know, it's equal opportunity denial of parental rights. And you know, the Muslim parents, like me, like your parents are, every parent with common sense is not going to surrender rights of their child over to the state, right? So they've this is exactly what we know, right? Like, it's not going to be able to be long lasting and to survive. Like, we will prevail. Like, we will win this war, because their intersectional alliance is so hypocritical and contradictory that it cannot sustain itself. But the people that are really fighting for values of, you know, that are righteous must stay steadfast, because just using my book and our conversation as an example, you know, it's been 20 years. This last few years of battle at the school, it's not how I thought, you know, my son's last high school years would go. I'd already been fighting the men at the mosque. I was like, oh, school, it's such a great place. Let me bring another cupcake to school, right? It was not what I planned. But, you know, we just have to go where the battle takes us sometimes, and just constantly stay true to our moral compass, you know, because to your deep, deep question, the nations, like the Western nations, they did have ill, like, what can I say, I'm trying to think of the word, where the alliance of ourselves with the Mujahideen, you know.
Oh, the unholy alliance. Yes.
Yeah, these unholy alliance, inopportune alliances, right? These, like, we have made those choices, and look at how that turned out. You know, they felt betrayed by America leaving that region. Well, it wouldn't have mattered whether we'd stayed or not. They would have turned on us, because ultimately, like, our values were not consistent with their Islamist values. And they will always turn on you when you have people that are contradictory, you know, to your own value system. And this left and Islamist alliance, it will turn on itself, right? But we have to stand up to it, because the damage that they're doing and that they're going to keep doing will be so irreversible in an individual child's life that we can't give them the years to do their damage at all.
Well, on that note, Astra, before I let you run, I wanted to ask what the latest is over at TJ. You have poured so much blood, sweat, and tears into your effort to help that school, along with some really inspiring other parents. Where do things stand, especially in the context of what you just said, that victories are being won, that the arc of the battle right now is on the side of progress? What's happening at TJ?
Yeah, so at TJ... we will be getting a, so as many people may or may not know, so I'll just quickly say, we fought a lawsuit as parents against the school board, and we won a civil rights decision in the federal court, a historic decision that established that the new admissions policy was racist and is racist. And this is so critical to know as a victory, because we were able to identify this new woke ideology as racist, right? It is a new racism. And the school board, being as stubborn as they want to be, filed an appeal. We will likely lose that appeal in the Fourth Circuit Court, where it's a 2-to-1 Democrat appointed judges to one who's siding with us. We expect that loss this spring, likely. And we will then, through our lawyers at Pacific Legal Foundation, an incredible place, appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I'm convinced and certain that we will win there. And our case of Coalition for TJ versus the Fairfax County School Board, or I like to call them the Unfairfax County School Board, we will win. And I know that this case will be as historic in the 21st century as Brown versus Board of Education in the 20th century. Our case captures the new racism of the woke ideology. And you know, in this new racism, merit is, you know, in the crosshairs, as are Asian students, and of course, all students who dare to defy the narrative, you know, of America being an oppressive nation. And that's why it's so important that we wage this fight, that we win. And Emily, you won't believe this, but in my prime, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to make it happen. Kim Kardashian can do it. I'm going to go to law school one day. And I have at least a good 20 years, I know, after I get my law degree, to wreak even more havoc on on this woke army. And so I just want to, you know, like, as we close up, just encourage everyone, and to just whatever place you find yourself, like, you are in your prime. You are in your prime, and don't let anybody tell you that you're not. And just, you know, stick to your values, write your thoughts down, publish your own book, and definitely please pick up my book, read it, share it with your friends, and write to me with any questions that you've got. Because one of my friends, I quote her in the book, and she says that there's this thing called suicidal empathy, where people can get blinded by, you know, the left's guilt trip. And their, you know, oppression Olympics and their grievance culture stuff. And what I try to do is make it so that you can be both insightful, like you can recognize what's happening in the world with kindness and thoughtfulness, and stand up to it with strength and courage and intellectual fortitude, so that you're not, your own brain is not hijacked, you know, by all their tactics of subversion. So I thank you so much. I mean, I was so excited to be able to talk to you, because you're just such a great listener and so smart and so great at allowing somebody to explain the most complicated ideas in a straightforward way. So thank you.
No, thank you, Astra. I was so excited to talk with you about this book, which, by the way, I'll give everyone the title again. It's called Woke Army, the Red-Green Alliance That is Destroying America's Freedom. Astra does a lot of work regularly for the Independent Women's Network, where she's a senior fellow. So you can absolutely follow that work. You should follow that work that Astra is doing over there. One more time, Astra Nomani, thank you so much once again for joining Federalist Radio Hour.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for all the great work that you and all the colleagues at The Federalist do for America.
Likewise. Well, you have been listening to another edition of The Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.